In this part of Focus, we will be talking about conditions for working families in the United States, and we'll be reviewing some of the findings in a recent report. In fact, it was just published just yesterday, looking at particularly what life is like for working poor families in the United States. And among other things, a major finding of this report is that more than one in four American working families now earn wages so low that they have a very tough time surviving financially. That's one of the key findings in this new report, which was conducted as part of the Working Poor Families Project. Now, this is something that was created in 2001 by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And the idea was to direct attention to issues and problems affecting working poor families in the United States. The project also has a couple of other major funders, those being the Ford and the Rockefeller Foundations. We'll be talking this morning with Brandon Roberts, and he was the author of this national report. Among other things, the report concludes that the economy has too many jobs that pay low wages, that have poor benefits, and also has really concerns about the education system that just doesn't prepare many workers for today's economy. As we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And just again, another quick word about our guest, Brandon Roberts. He's president of Brandon Roberts and Associates. It's a public policy consultant organization. They specialize in economic and workforce development matters. And he works primarily with state and local level organizations to develop and implement policies and program activities and also evaluate past efforts. Before starting this company, he served as the deputy director of the Council of State Community Development Agencies in Washington, D.C., and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Roberts, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, and particularly thanks for focusing attention on this issue.
Well, we certainly think that it is an important one, and I'm really glad that you could be with us in such a timely sort of frame because just the report just came out yesterday, and I think just as recently as yesterday morning I was reading about this in the newspaper, and I thought, well, this would be something good for us to be talking about, and I'm really pleased that so quickly we could make the program happen, because I'm sure that there are a lot of demands on you to and your time to talk about it.
Well, I'm pleased that I could join you today.
Well, I guess to start out, we probably should do some defining about what it is we're talking about, in case people really aren't sure about the group of people that we're talking about, mm-hmm. the families that we're talking about.
Sure.
First of all, how does one define this? What is a low-income working family?
That's an excellent point, and one that we always want to be clear that everyone understands. One of the aspects of our study is that we've been able, I think, for the first time, certainly from this perspective, to take a unique look at working families in America. And we were able to do that because of a new data source produced by the Census Department called the American Community Survey. And it allows us to look at working families at a national level and for each of the 50 states. We define a working family, we look at it in two ways. First off, we're concerned with working families that have children under the age of 18. So that's a subset of all working families in the U.S. We're talking about 60 million approximately working families. Our subset of children under 18 is about 36 million. We then look and say, to be working, what does that mean? And we've imposed a fairly rigorous test in terms of defining that someone is a working family, and that is folks in that family need to be engaged in the labor market for 39 weeks out of the year. And in fact, as we've done this, as you'll see in our report, the average family that we have considered is puts in about 2,500 hours of work each year, which is the equivalent of one full-time worker and a quarter-time worker. Hmm. And then, of course, the other dimension to this is that how do we define low income? Because we look at all these working families with children and say, what percentage or how many of those earn up to 200% of poverty? And 200% of poverty for a family of four, in rough terms, is that they earn approximately $36,000 a year. So from that's how we get to identifying that there are 9.2 million working families with children in America that we consider or define as low income.
Okay. And just for, again, as a point of reference now, what is the federal poverty level? What's the dollar figure?
Well, it differs from family size, but we typically, and what we talk about in our report kind of as a benchmark for people to think about, is that for a four-person family, which can be one adult and three children, or it could be two adults and two children, is a little over $18,000.
Okay.
So when you take that and say 200%, which has become a fairly standard way for people to look at what the term people think of economic self-sufficiency, poverty is not considered to be a very good measure of that any longer, the poverty standard. So a lot of people do take it to 200%, which seems like a more realistic gauge. So that takes that 18,000 up to 36,000.
So I think also in the report you make an important point in when you get into this question of who is it that you're talking about. It's in addition to talking about who these people are, I think you make a good point in talking about who they are not, that gets at some of the ideas that people have about low-income working families. That is, they think, well, in fact, what we're talking about here is a lot of low-income families don't work, that these are families headed by single parents. They may well be families headed by immigrants. They may be families that where there are parents, but they're very young. And that mostly what we're talking about here is people who are minorities. And in fact, when you look at these people that you are profiling in this report, none of those things are true.
Exactly. I mean, that to some extent, that was new news to us in a sense. One of the things about this database is it really does allow you to take a good look at the characteristics of these families. And just as you said, I mean, we have these perceptions in America that have been built up over many years and decades that people are poor or they're low income because they don't work. Well, in fact, we show that 71% of low income families actually work, and they work hard. As I said a minute ago, 2,500 on average, 2,500 hours a year. That's a significant amount of work. These are families that work hard, want to get ahead, and aspire to better economic futures for their children, just like many other families in this country. And you did mention, and I think one of the things that we were particularly struck with is that, well, people think these families, they're all headed by single mothers, and that's not the case. 53% are headed by married couples. And so there are a lot of we actually have a little box in our report that talks about the myths and facts about low-income working families. And I think it's quite important to draw attention to these because I think to some extent this plays a role in perhaps why this issue does not get more attention.
Yeah.
And we can talk a little bit more about that in a little bit.
Yeah, and the other, I think one other that is in that section that I think is very striking is gets to this notion that, well, somehow we think that we're talking about really young people here. And in fact, one of your findings is that 88% of low-income working families have a parent that's somewhere between 25 and 54.
Exactly, and that's the prime working age. You know, if you're not making it then, if you're not above that status at then, what else is going to happen in your life that's going to allow you to earn more money?
Hmm. Over time, what's the trend in the percentage of families working poor? Is it more or less the same?
Well, you know, one of the things with this data set that we're able to use just came online into the year 2000. So we do not do comparison of these particular working families. We can look, there are other trends that other studies out there that suggest that, you know, I mean, our first point, let me back up a second. Our first point is what our study shows is that this is a significant issue in itself, whether it's getting better, getting worse. 27.4% of all working families being low income is notable in itself and worthy of attention today. We need to do something about it. When you look at some of the other studies of the past, some of the other data, you begin to see that things perhaps have not gotten any better or, you know, I don't want to say that they necessarily have gotten worse, but we haven't made a lot of headway. You can look at poverty, the poverty statistics for families. And now you have to realize that one of the differences between our study and the poverty statistics is the poverty includes people who work and don't work. But just using that as a proxy, we see that the poverty rate really has not changed. Today it's about the same as it was in the 1970s, whether we're talking about for families or we're talking about individuals. So yes, there's been some up and down in poverty based on the economy, but overall it's appreciably remained the same. Mm. We do cite a study in our report that, you know, there are labor economists out there that look at mobility issues, how low-income families move up and what percentage of them do so. The Boston Federal Reserve did a study that we cite that shows that during the 1990s, actually the number of families that can move out of low-income status up into the middle class has declined from the 1980s, and that's during the 1990s, which was a big boom period for us. So the evidence out there is not strong, or is you know, is not that hopeful that things are getting better.
One other bit of say demographic information that also says something about the role that government policy plays is that if you take a look from one, if you look from one state to another, you really see that the percentage of low-income working families is really different from one state to another. And in some cases, it can be relatively small, and in some cases, it can be relatively large. And you have to say that it has to do with a number of things. I suppose the health of the economy in that state has something to do with it. But I would also imagine that the kind of supports that are available for low-income families, that also has something to do with it.
Very much so. I mean, the range among the states is quite incredible. And once again, you know, that's what this data set allows us to do, to get reliable data at the state level. So you can go for a low of 14.6, 14.8 in states like Connecticut and Massachusetts to a high over 35% of working families being low income in a, you know, a half a dozen other states, including, you know, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Louisiana, some states that you think about when you think about the number of poor people there. We are not in a position to say exactly why that difference, but we do provide in our study 16 indicators that look across for each of the 50 states. And so when you start looking through those, you can see factors that do influence perhaps the success of those families. So, for example, the percentage of low-income working families that have high school degrees. About one in three do not have a high school degree. But once again, that varies substantially from state to state across the country. Another thing that we profile in our report is that while we have a federal minimum wage in this country of $5.15, states can enact their own minimum wage, as the state of Illinois has done. And there are 12 states that have done that. I don't think it's any coincidence that three of the states actually with the lowest percentage of low-income working families are states that have their own state minimum wage. Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Alaska. That obviously has to have a bearing on the earnings of those families.
Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Brandon Roberts. He is someone who works in this area and has been for a long time as a kind of public policy analyst. He has a firm, Brandon Roberts and Associates, that's a public policy consultant. They specialize in economic and workforce development issues. And he now, for some time, has been involved in this project that I mentioned at the beginning. It's called the Working Poor Families Project, that was created by the Annie E. Casey Foundation to assess how well states are doing in their efforts to help the working poor. And as part of this project, this new report has just come out. In fact, it was just made public, just released yesterday, and it's called Working Hard, Falling Short, which takes a look at what conditions are like for America's working families. And by the way, if you're interested in reading the report and seeing some of what is in it, probably the easiest way to do that would be to go to the website of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and it's a pretty easy address, www.aecf.org. And there you would find more information about the Working Poor Families Project. And if you want to read the report, it's there. And of course, here on this program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just there are a number of places here we can go to talk about both what's going on in these families and what could be done to try to provide them more assistance. Just to pick up on the last point that you made, because it is often one of the first things that people talk about, and that is the minimum wage. Now, the federal minimum wage is $5.15
an
hour, and certainly a lot of criticism has been made about whether or not, in fact, you can actually a family could actually make ends meet if they have minimum wage workers supporting the family. How much difference would it make if we could increase that, and would the increase that it would take to actually make a difference be, what would you have to look at and say, well, politically speaking, you might as well forget it because that's just not going to happen?
Well, I mean, let me kind of address that question from several perspectives. One, we do have a chart in our report, chart one, where we trace the minimum wage as a percentage of poverty for the last 40 years, going back to 1965. And it used to be in this country that the federal minimum wage, if you went out and you worked hard, worked 40 hours a week, and earned the minimum wage, and let's say you were a family of three with one person working, you would earn enough money to be above poverty. In fact, you could be 170% above poverty in terms of what you earn for that year. Somewhere in the early 1980s, that trend, it started reversing itself in the late 60s, but by the 1980s, the value of that minimum wage relative to poverty had fallen substantially and, in fact, fell below the poverty level. So today, if you, that same worker using the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour and the poverty threshold for a family of three, they would only earn 74% of the poverty threshold today. So we've gone from 120% above to 74% below. So that just shows you to some extent that we're not really keeping pace with things in terms of public policy here. The other thing is if you actually do a calculation, if we consider, you know, we tend to use a family of four pretty much throughout our report, but if you talk about a family of four with two adults, and both of those adults go to work every day, work 40 hours a week for 52 weeks a year, and earn the minimum wage, their combined income is going to be $21,424. That's the total for the two of them, two people putting in 80 hours a week. That doesn't go very far in today's economy and doesn't really lay much of a foundation for a family to support itself and to support its children in terms of looking for the future.
Let's talk with some callers. We have a couple of people here who are ready to go, and we'll start with line one in Champaign.
Hi, just out of curiosity, I was wondering if you in your report have any information on as far as like low-income people and the percentage of them who vote or are registered to vote, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
No, unfortunately, we don't. That would be a very timely piece of data to have, given the period we're in right now. But that's not something that, we're really looking at this these families from the perspective of their work effort, their ability to succeed in the economy. So, as you mentioned earlier, Dave, we've been doing this for the last since 2001, and we do work at the state level. We're working with organizations in 15 states, including groups in Illinois. And as we do that, while this national report, we wanted to make it readable, accessible to folks, so we included 16 of the indicators. When we end up working with one of our state organizations, we have over 100 indicators that we look at, that we gather information on. But even at that point, unfortunately, voting and registration is not one of those indicators.
Yeah. Well, and maybe I point out, too, that if people are interested in looking at some of the information about Illinois, that's also available on the Casey Foundation website.
Exactly. Right. They prepared a report very similar to this, but more exhaustive, using a good part of the 100 indicators last year, and did an excellent job. And I think people will find it a very compelling read, and offering a very important set of recommendations and actions to think about and perhaps to talk about from a public policy perspective.
Well, let me ask you a related question, a political question, and that is this election season, this presidential election race, the main topic of conversation has been Iraq and American foreign policy, and perhaps not quite so much about domestic issues. Now, in the debate we're going to have tonight, that's supposed to be the focus. But even in some of the other conversations that both candidates have had, it seems that when they talk about economic issues, at least particularly for the Democrats, there's a lot of focus on the middle class. And I guess I wonder if you could talk about to what extent either party, the Democratic Party, the Republicans, have talked about or seem to be giving some attention to the kinds of issues that we're talking about this morning and in this hour that specifically apply to low-income working families. I mean, is anybody really talking about this?
Well, Dave, we, you know, when we started this project 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, we certainly started it from the perspective that this issue was not getting sufficient attention. And in fact, that's been a major focus of ours, is to bring attention to this issue that there are, you know, as our report shows, 9.2 million working families out there, people who are working hard, playing by the rules, but still struggling to make ends meet. We made a conscious effort in this report to really provide an objective, data-driven document that's not written to advance any type of political agenda or suggest any problems attributable to any candidates or anything else. Having said that, we release this report now because we think it's important to draw attention to this issue, and we don't think it's gotten sufficient attention. So we very much hope that by raising this issue at this point in time, and we're not talking about, as you've mentioned before and I've discussed, we work at the state level as well. So we're not just thinking about drawing attention to this issue through the presidential campaign. We see this as an issue that both national, state, and local leaders need to be discussing. That's the major part of why we think it's important to get the word out. And we do hope people pick up on it, that we do hope that there are informed discussions about what we should be doing about this.
Okay, let's talk with someone else here. This is also Champagne, and it's line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. I find this a very enlightening report. And what is it, 1 out of 5 American families are what we call working class poor?
1 out of 4.
An astounding number. When was the last time the minimum wage was changed in this country? When did we enact a $5.15 federal minimum wage?
1997, I think, is when it went into effect.
And every time there's been an effort, I think, by people like Senator Kennedy and others, there has been strong opposition to it, primarily from members of the Republican Party.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where the opposition. I do know that we have not made the changes as you've suggested in recent years. It has been an issue that's been considered, and we hope by drawing attention to this that we can get that issue back into the public dialogue. It's an important one, we believe, and as we say in our report, we talk. And very rightly so, whether we're talking about welfare reform in this country or whatever, about the value of work, the need to work. And I think we really need to have a serious discussion about sufficiently rewarding work.
Well, the reason I asked that, and I know you said this is a nonpartisan document, there will be those who say the time in which it comes out, about, what, 2 or 3 weeks from a very important election, makes it partisan regardless of your subjective intentions. My question to you is, as we have recently $136 billion corporate giveaway tax and we have a income tax relief to a wealthy group of Americans, and then we talk about squeezing the middle class, which I'm a member of, what happens, and I think this may have been alluded to by David, the millions of Americans where the rags to riches racial algebra phenomenon is virtually non-existent in light of what you just cited as in terms of stagnant wages, lower wages than necessary for a living wage. What's happened to the racial algebra, rags to riches, social mobility phenomenon of American society?
That's an excellent point, and that's very much on target with what we're trying to raise with this report. I think one of the things that we've come to recognize, and most Americans are coming to understand one way or the other, is that the economy, no matter how hard you work, does not necessarily guarantee economic security and advancement any longer. And so we believe, and as we've articulated in this report, it's in our national interest that we come to recognize that our public systems out there, and we've got systems that are designed to support these families, that to assist them and provide opportunities for upward mobility and advancement. And I think we've reached the point now where we really need to take a serious look as to whether those current systems are sufficient and up to the task of really addressing the need. Agree with you 100% that that's an area that really deserves attention.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll get right to you. Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're talking with Brandon Roberts. He is the president of Brandon Roberts & Associates. It's a public policy consulting firm. And for now a number of years, he's been working with the Working Poor Families Project, which was something that was created in 2001 to look at state efforts to assist the working poor. It was started by the Annie E. Casey Foundation and now also gets support from two other big foundations, the Ford Foundations and the Rockefeller Foundation. And they have just issued a report, just came out yesterday. It's titled Working Hard, Falling Short, America's Working Families and the Pursuit of Economic Security. And again, if you'd like to read it, you can go to the website of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, www.aecf.org, and you can take a look at it. And our guest this morning, Brandon Roberts, was the author of the report. And we're talking specifically about some of the things that are in it. As we've mentioned here, one of the bottom line conclusions is that more than one in four American working families now earn wages so low that they have a really tough time surviving financially. One of the things that you point out in the report, and you mentioned a little bit earlier, is that contrary to the perception that some people might have that low-income families are not working, here in the case of these families, we're talking about people are working and they're working hard. And when you tote up the number of hours people are working in these families, where we have families that are putting in the equivalent of, you know, roughly 1.25 jobs. So they indeed are working. But the problem is that the kind of wage, let alone the benefit issue, the kind of wages that they're receiving just isn't enough to support their family. So then if you ask this question, well, what's the most significant deficit that these people have going into the job market? It looks like it's education, that the significant numbers of these workers didn't finish high school, so they don't have a high school diploma or may not have education past that. And it seems like that's the one big thing that they're struggling with as they're going out there trying to find something that will pay a decent wage that they can support their family on.
You're exactly right, David. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about, you know, comparison or trends over time. One of the trends that is quite factual as well as compelling with respect to the economy is that increasingly, your wages, your earnings are very much tied to your education and your skills levels. And that's changing. That's continuing to move in that direction. So the gap between those who don't have a high school degree or even a high school degree and those who have community college degrees or you know, four-year college degree is growing and growing. And so if you want to get ahead in this economy for the future, those education and skills are going to be quite important. And as we see from our data, we can talk about the K-12 system, which is quite important to do, but there's a significant number of families and workers out there already who are in a situation that they don't have the education and the skills to get ahead and to contribute to the economy. Two points there. First, businesses need them. We still, even during an economic decline, hear from businesses about shortages for skilled workers. They need those workers. They're going to need them even more so in the future. The second point is that we do have a set of public systems, federal and state supported, that are designed to help adults get education and skills to be able to move ahead, whether it's going back to get their high school equivalent diploma, whether it's to get specific occupational skills. We have a set of systems out there that we've relied on for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years to do that. I think one of the cases we make in our report is that we need to really re-examine those systems. We're of the perspective that they need to be strengthened significantly if they're going to address the needs of these low-income working families. Just to cite you one specific example, there's 27 million adults in this country without a high school degree. We have a federal state program that's designed to assist those adults to get degrees. Only 2.7, one-tenth, were enrolled in the adult education programs last year, and that's only enrolled. That doesn't begin to even get at the issue of how many of them succeeded and actually, you know, made some progress as a result of being in those programs. So we've got our work cut out for us in that respect.
All right. We have a number of callers here. We want to get them in, and we'll go next to Belgium, community over by Danville near us, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. The point I wanted to ask you about was the fact that we seem to be pushing ourselves farther and farther in that direction by forcing jobs off of our country into other countries, and then from those countries we force them into even cheaper labor areas. So this minimum wage is really pretty pointless anymore if you think about it, because every corporation, the first thing they want to get rid of is wages, whether you're skilled or unskilled, because there's a lot of jobs going to India for very skilled people. And also the aspect that during this time that wages are going down, health care becomes worse and worse for the people who can afford it the least, which then causes problems, because if you're not well enough to go to work, nobody wants to hire you.
Respond to that. We really did not, the first issue you raise, I understand what you're talking about, but that's not really something that we focused on in on our study. We did, on the second issue, though, we did take a look at the availability of health care for low-income working families across the country. And that is, I will say, one of the more significant findings of our report that was really very revealing to us as we looked at the 50 states. As you may know, the federal government in partnership with the states do provide access to Medicaid, health care for low-income people, but the states actually administer that program and determine who is eligible to participate. And as we show in our report, determining who is eligible varies from state to state, and it's based on how much money you earn. So if you look in one state, a family of four maybe lose their eligibility for Medicaid health care when their earnings reach approximately $4,000. However, they could move across the state line to another state or somewhere else in the country, and they could earn up to $30,000 and still be eligible for that Medicaid health care. So there, what we have is we look at our federal and state systems across the country, we have a very uneven commitment, if you will, from state to state in terms of their ability and their commitment to support these working families in very important ways that influence their ability to do well at work and to move ahead.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Back here to Urbana. This is line 1. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. This community, as you may know, is set to get 3 super Walmarts. We already have one, and I guess 2 more are coming in. But I'm wondering, does your study look at at the jobs that Walmart provide, and do they actually lift people out of poverty, or do they keep them there?
Well, we didn't look at the jobs Walmart provides per se, but we did do analysis around the types of jobs that these low-income families hold. And you won't be surprised that as we look at these type of jobs, they are the typical service jobs that might show up in that type of environment. We're talking about cashiers, housekeepers, health aide, cooks, waiters and waitresses. In fact, our study found that among the working families that we looked at that would be considered poor, and that's below that $18,000 threshold we talked about earlier in the show, a fifth of all workers are employed in those 5 jobs that we just mentioned.
I had also seen somewhere that people in these low-wage jobs qualify for federal assistance for their health care. And so, you know, there are often hidden costs. You know, when a Walmart or some other company like that comes to town, saying that they're creating jobs, there are actually hidden costs that the community will have to bear.
You're exactly right, and we make a point of that gets to the point I just made a few minutes ago about the uneven commitment to things like health care from state to state that can vary. But on a general point, there are paying people, underpaying them and underemploying them has costs not only for them, but it also has costs for society and government at large. And we actually devote a little bit of discussion about that in our report.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. When you look at the kind of jobs that we're talking about, how many of them come with some kind of benefit? And I guess I would think the most basic benefit that you might be interested in would be some kind of health care. What do these jobs provide people in addition to the wage, or do they, in fact, provide much in addition to the wage?
Well, unfortunately, our data doesn't give us a very clear picture on that. We can only kind of go on general trends looking at, you know, we can't say for our particular families per se. But when you think about housekeepers, cashiers, and these type of things, I mean, most of the studies that you see and understanding of what's taking place in the labor market, these positions don't come with significant benefits. And even when they do come with something like health care, you know, we've increasingly got to the point with company-sponsored health care that there's a cost to that. And when you're asked to pay a couple hundred dollars to contribute your share, if you will, a couple hundred dollars a month to be able to get the company health care, that begins raising serious questions for people who are earning, you know, $20,000 to $25,000 a year. Where does that couple hundred dollars come from, and what's the trade-off of doing that versus something else? It creates a very difficult situation.
We continue. Next up is another Urbana caller, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know when in Illinois the minimum wage went into effect?
You know, I don't, I must say. I don't know that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was here, and I remember, and it was in the late 50s, and I'll tell you why it even started. It was because minimum wage is designed for, when it started, for students, part-time help, things of that nature, to work in grocery stores and selling hamburgers and blah, blah, blah. It was never designed to make a living on. And you people keep going on about the poor people can't make a living on this. It started to help the people instead of making 50 cents an hour, and I'm not 100% sure if it was 75 cents or a dollar and a quarter an hour. It was because these people wasn't paying these kids enough to warrant this. It wasn't designed to make a living off of. So where are you getting this information about these people can't make a living off of this?
Well, I mean, we're just looking at the facts, as they say, and, you know, it's interesting you raise that because very clearly the data show that in the 60s and the 70s, one could make support a family off of that above the poverty level.
You're not answering what I'm asking you. It was designed for students and kids, you know, part-time help type thing, nickel-dime jobs, I'll use that term. It wasn't designed to make a living off of. So you can't keep going back and say, well, so-and-so can't make a living off of this, because that wasn't the intent of a minimum wage. Yeah, do you agree with that or you disagree?
Well, I've never heard that portrayal of that being the reason for the minimum wage.
Well, you're not old enough then.
I was going to say, the minimum wage has been around for a while. It predates me, but
you need to go back.
My understanding was it was always set to create a threshold and to bring some, you know, if you look at what the minimum wage is, it's not just that law in itself. These are federal employment standards that were put on the books, you know, some many years ago, and those standards deal with a whole range of things in addition to pay.
I just wanted you to know that I was there, and I remember when the minimum wage went into effect. That was the reason why minimum wage even started. You know, it was just for part-time kids to make a dollar or two without, you know, getting ripped too bad because it was getting underpaid. That's why it was there. It wasn't made to make a living on. So that's the point I'm trying to make.
Well, that's contrary to my understanding, but that's an interesting.
All right. Well, I've got to jump in here because we have a number of other callers, and I want to go on.
Okay.
And maybe also just real quick introduce again our guest. We have just about 10 minutes left. Brandon Roberts. He is the president of a public policy consultant organization that does work for the Annie E. Casey Foundation. They were the ones that started this project, the Working Poor Families Project, in 2001. Started it to try to get an idea of what states were doing to help the working poor in their states. And just now, within the last day, a new report has come out that looks at America's working families and what conditions are like for them. It's titled Working Hard, Falling Short. It's a national report, and if you're interested in reading it, you can go to the website of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and take a look at it. Questions here are certainly welcome, and we'll continue. And the next up is Urbana, line three is the caller. Hello.
Hello. Well, you've been talking about what I was going to ask about, but I want to respond to the immediate previous caller that I was around here back then too, and I completely disagree with him. I think that was not the reason for the minimum wage. The minimum wage was to provide a basic wage for a standard of living for working families. And but anyway, I getting back to the matter of how the jobs break down among these the working poor. You mentioned a number of jobs, and you said that it accounted for about a fifth of them. Where are the other four-fifths working?
I'm sorry, the other
four-fifths working. You said that those are the cashiers and the...
What type of jobs?
Yeah, what type of jobs?
The professional, managerial, you know, the whole variety of jobs that are out there. Or do you mean the remaining of the other
The other working poor.
The other working poor. Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't quite follow that. They work in the type of jobs that you know, we see and rely on, whether we're talking about health aides, we're talking about security guards, delivery folks. I mean, there's a whole variety of occupations these folks are employed in, but you know, some have called them the invisible poor. David Chipler did a book that came out earlier this year on the working poor, and he kind of subtitled his books America's Invisible Workers. And you know, to a large extent, these are workers that are fundamental parts of our economy day to day. They perform, perhaps some might say, some basic or routine functions, but these are critical functions that we rely on. And these are not the type of jobs that are going to, you know, be sent abroad. They're jobs that are going to remain. And in fact, when you look at the projections of growth in jobs, these jobs are continuing to grow. They're a part of our economy. They're going to be a part of our economy. You know, you also find them in agricultural situations as well. So I think it's real important that it's an important discussion that we need to have about rewarding these jobs or the folks who work in these jobs sufficiently to support their families.
Does your study actually break down by employment, say, and also by state? Would that be found on the website?
We don't break it down by state. We have done, for our internal purposes, to come up with the type of characteristics that I gave you before in terms of those five positions. We did break it down into a number of different occupations and looked at it. And I don't have that right in front of me. It's not something that we wanted to keep this report short and manageable, so hopefully people would read it and it would be somewhat digestible. But
okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line four, the caller in southeastern Illinois. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of the program, and my comments may not be related entirely to your report, but I would like to comment on the fact that a lot of poor young families do not want to move. The labor force is not perfectly mobile. And if they move, and they may not even want to take training, my brother taught in a junior college in a highly technical program, And he had students who would not be willing, even though they had the training, they would not be willing to go somewhere where they could make a lot more money. And I think it's because their extended families aren't going to go with them. And they won't have grandma there to look after the kids. And the specter of having to pay a lot for child care and things like that in another community where they're, you know, they don't know anyone and they don't have anybody to help in their family to help support them psychologically and in real terms.
Yeah, I mean, you raise an excellent point. And one of the key findings in our report is that the commitment to doing this is very uneven, as I've said several times before. And so we're not looking, we certainly wouldn't advocate, young families or any families for that matter, moving to try and adjust to this. We think that there needs to be a level playing field across the country so that the resources and the supports that is available in one community or one state does not differ substantially in another community or another state somewhere else in the country. We did, you may have missed earlier, but one of the points that David noted here is that most of the low-income working families that ended up in our study have parents between the ages of 25 and 54. So this is not strictly a phenomena of young families.
Right, right. Well, I just wanted to make the point about mobility because I think when people look at the overall figures on employment and that and where the jobs are, that they totally miss the mm-hmm. mobility issue.
Yep.
Yeah, well, thanks for the call.
All right, thank you.
Let's go
Bye-bye.
To Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Line two?
No, this is line one.
Okay, anyway.
Well, yes, go ahead. You're on. Go ahead.
I'm calling to ask if there are military personnel who fall into this category.
I'm not sure about that. I can't answer that. You mean in the sense of military families that would be low-income working families?
Exactly.
We didn't particularly look specifically at that. It wouldn't surprise me if there are.
Yeah, I understand that a lot of military families are actually eligible for food stamps and that type of thing. So I would assume then that they are. Wonder how if you did a breakdown of what kind of jobs they are employed in, how that could have been missed then if it's the case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, good point. Of course, people are eligible for food stamps based on their income. Doesn't really matter what they're doing, what their occupation is. It's,
right.
it's income-driven. So if they're eligible, that's a reflection of the earnings that they're receiving.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and again, one more caller here, Matt Toon, line two. Hello.
Hi, I just want to quickly respond to the caller who was talking about how he was around when minimum wage came in and it wasn't designed to provide a living wage. I was working in a factory in Mattoon at the time. My wage in 1973, and with the first minimum wage, my wage went up to a grand total of $2.10 an hour that I was earning working full-time loading trucks. So it was more, we also, our family owned a business in which high school kids were getting 90 cents an hour and a college kid working part-time in the late 60s when we started was getting a dollar an hour. So it did impact them, but it was also designed to help adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because before the minimum wage went in, there were people working full-time supporting their families in this factory making less than $2 an hour.
All right.
So, and I know you said that you didn't think that was correct, and I was there too, and I know it wasn't correct.
Okay, good. Dave, I can point out to the readers, if you go to the U.S. Department of Labor, they do have a website devoted to the minimum wage. They provide a history on it. They also identify what the state minimum wage laws are for the 50 states across the country, and you can go to www.dol.gov/ESA. And look for general information on the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is part of the minimum wage.
We just pretty much have to stop here. I guess I just real quick, one of the earlier points you made is that one of the things you've been trying to do all along is simply to get attention devoted to working families and their needs. Are you optimistic at all that these issues will get some more attention?
Well, certainly we've been gratified over the last 48 hours as our report has come out. You know, people like yourself, Dave, who have picked this up and are talking about it. We've gotten quite a bit of publicity across the country and attention to this issue. So I think the key thing for us is we've been able to demonstrate or at least have this study be in a position of generating that attention. I think the key challenge is being able to follow up on it and be able to be in a position of as we suggest in our report, fostering an ongoing discussion of how we address this issue.
Well, there we will leave it. I guess I want to mention one more time, if people are interested in reading this report that we've been talking about, Working Hard, Falling Short, probably the easiest thing to do, go to the website of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, www.aecf.org, and you can see it there. Our guest for this part of Focus 580, Brandon Roberts, was author of that report. Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David, for having me.